Okay, well, we're going to jump in and get started here for this week's Q&A as part of the sprints. I don't think we have any major announcements. So as always, as we go through it, you can put your questions in the chat. We had a couple submitted ahead of time, and we'll just hang in here for a little while and let me know if you need anything as we go through it. I'll be monitoring the chat. So Sean, let's just start here. This is from Dana. What's your process for analyzing a masterwork? How long does it take you to work through one? And when you're done, what collateral do you have for future reference? How would you suggest a person handle analyzing their first masterwork?
Okay, well, I'm actually doing a masterwork now. I'm going through The Hobbit for the Hero's Journey course that we'll be offering in July. And the way I handle it is it's pretty simple, and it's takes a long time. So the first thing I do is sort of the way I walk through people how to analyze a scene and ground your craft is I build a spreadsheet. I build the story grid spreadsheet from scene to scene. And so for a novel like The Hobbit, it's there's many instances where there are multiple scenes in a particular chapter. So what I do is I'll read a chapter and then I'll try and divide it. Is this one scene, two scenes, whatever? And the way I divide scenes are usually subjective interpretations by me. I'm not doing it with anyone else, so it's really for me. So I'll divide it. So I think the first chapter of The Hobbit has two or three scenes in it, as I recall. And then I'll literally, I usually buy it on Kindle or some kind of ebook so that I can cut and paste the text, because I like to work very, very specifically. So when I have it up on the screen, it could be whatever software program you like, I'll do all the easy stuff first. So I'll begin with the far right columns of just identifying characters as they emerge, you know, line by line. And I'll highlight them, and then I'll put them in the character list on the side. And then as I start to get a feel for it, then I'm able to sort of move from right to left, and I'll do, you know, where it takes place, location, time period. All of those sort of details, those continuity details that are easy to intuit, and you can pick out the answers very quickly. And then as I go, I'll eventually settle in my mind, oh, this is definitely third person omniscient. Ah, great. So then I'll go and I'll do the point of view column. And as you can see, what I'm doing is I'm slowly moving from right to left. It's counterintuitive for us American and English readers. So then I'll get to word count. So then I'll go all the way to the top and I'll do all the easy stuff first, basically. And then after I've read the scene, I'll walk through my analysis. So because I'll be doing this as a story grid masterwork guide for The Hobbit, I'll walk through all of those meticulous questions, the six core questions. Well, it's not actually the six core questions. It's those set of, I believe there are four questions that I answer at the end of every Pride and Prejudice scene. If you have the Story Grid Pride and Prejudice guide to, the Story Grid guide to Pride and Prejudice, you'll know what I'm talking about. So it's things like, what are the characters literally doing here? What's the, you know, the core action? What is the sort of the want? And then that'll boil me down into understanding the value shift, which is a big, big win. once I know the value shift, then I can fill it in on my spreadsheet. And then I'll try and sum up the entire scene in the fewest words possible and stick that in story event. And then to top it all off, because this is a guide, I'm going to be doing the five commandments. So I will think through the inciting incident, the turning point progressive complication, the crisis, the climax, and the resolution. And I'll do this for every single scene. Yeah, it's a lot of work, right? So a single scene can take me, and I've been doing this for 20 years, right? 30 years. Actually, it took me about 10 years to figure out how to do it, and then I've been doing it. All right, so even me doing it takes between 10 to 15 minutes per scene. Now, for people who are just starting out, I suspect that's probably a half hour. Half hour of work per scene. And you can't half-ass it. Because if you half-ass it, you're just going to kick yourself later and say, you know, I really should have just done the full half hour on that one scene. Because now I don't trust the material that I wrote earlier in the spreadsheet. So what this process will do for you is it's remarkable. Because what it does is it basically beats the shit out of resistance from moment to moment to moment, because you know exactly what you have to do. I'm not saying it's fun, but you know exactly what you have to do. At no point do you ever feel lost or, oh, I'm never going to be good at this. You're just like, now I have to do the value shift. Let me think it through. So what you're doing is you're really laser focusing your mind into the heart and soul of storytelling. And so when you have a masterwork and you do this scene after scene after scene, what you get very, very good at it. And it doesn't really, if you do one masterwork analysis, now the very first class of StoryGrid certified editors, they had to do a masterwork analysis. And they had, I think, about 6 months to complete the work. And they all completed the work. They were all certified. But every single one of them still is working through their masterworks because they're learning more and more and more each time they go through it. So we haven't even published. We're sitting on a lot of StoryGrid masterwork guides that are certified editors have been working on, and they're actually decided to, this is what happens when you take the pill, you know. Now they're having like other editors review their work to make sure that they're aligning, right? So it's a really, really amazing thing when you start getting into these masterworks. All right, so what do you get out of this is, I think, the last part of this question. What you get out of this is such a deep happiness for yourself, because you're going to learn story at a level that is just remarkable. All right, so that's the first thing. You're going to start to feel comfortable being able to point out and pick out the five commandments of storytelling in a particular scene. The second thing that you're going to learn is, once you have those 60 scenes or however many, I think The Hobbit's going to have around 40 to 50, maybe 60. Once you have those 60 scenes, then what you can do is you can pull back and really get an understanding of the global maneuvering that Tolkien or whoever has written your masterwork or Austin has actually created here. And you see all of the little Lego pieces that combine to create this thing that what emerges from this scene by scene analysis is a sum greater than its parts. And you could begin to see the master, the macro, right? And when you get that macro, you say, oh my gosh, it's the combination of the setup of that payoff 19 scenes later that gave me the arc and the emotional catharsis. That, wow, I mean, when you look at the building blocks, any one scene isn't massively spectacular. I mean, they're all really amazing. But when you look at them in total, it's now you see how they're building the progressive complications to create the catharsis. So we're releasing our May book is called The Four Core Framework. And that's all about these four core major elements that you can use as a macro tool to check your catharsis, right? So the way, what I do as I create these masterwork guides is I learn more and more and better about the uses of micro tools that create catharsis. And then that informs me as the story grid guy, and I can take that information and I can say, oh boy, this is an even better, higher resolution understanding of what exactly one does to create catharsis across multiple genres. So what you learn doing this cannot, it's kind of like the Gnostic idea of you can't really understand an experience until you go through it. So unless you have a child, you don't really know what it's like to have a child. Unless you've had a new job, you don't know what it's like to be in that new job. So all I can say is just do it. Just find that favorite book of yours and say, you know what, I'm going to make my masterwork guide for this. Nobody's going to take a look at it. But if you commit to this effort and you do, and so just to go back on how I handle the workload is I only do about five scenes a day. So first thing in the morning when after I've had my coffee, I do my five scenes and then I'm exhausted from my analysis and then I put it away and I move on. So don't try and do, I would suggest you do one a day, right? So do one a day, do it first thing in the morning, and that's going to be a victory. So after you finish that one scene, I guarantee you're going to feel really good about yourself and you're going to feel refreshed. And then if you start working on your own writing from that point, it's like this really priming the pump of your creative power. So that's the way I do it. I take it piece by piece. All told, I suspect it's a good 150 to 200 hours of intense work to do all those steps for every single scene. And then after, so that's basically creating the story grid spreadsheet. And then after that, to do the macro foolscap page isn't so hard. That takes maybe an hour. So you're able to bang that out very quickly because you've already done the micro. Then to create the story grid infographic, that's another long process that's probably another 40 hours. And I only do that five scenes at a time. So when I created the infographic for Tim's novel, I laid out 2 weeks and I did it five scenes at a time. And that is through experience. That's the best method to create something that you can refer to in the future. Okay, so now I say I have my infographic of The Hobbit. And I have someone asked me a question, like, how do I get emotional catharsis at the ending payoff of a heroic journey epic fantasy novel? At first I'm gonna go like, oh shit, I don't know, right? And then I'll go, oh my gosh, I have the answer. Here's The Hobbit, let me take a look. How did he set that up and how did he pay it off, right? So if you have a whole catalog of specific masterwork genre and you have spreadsheets and foolscap pages, when you face a problem, you're not alone anymore. And you can say, I don't really know how to really move that forward in that middle build. Then you pull out your spreadsheets and you go, this is how Tolkien did it. This is how Austin did it. This is how whoever. And so this is the whole strategy, the grand, long, drip-by-drip strategy of StoryGrid, is to compile these resources for creative people such that when they get stuck and they're ready to throw in the towel, they can have this insight and say, oh, I'm not alone. I can just go to the StoryGrid stuff and find multiple answers to my specific question. And those multiple answers will inspire me. So that's what I believe StoryGrid Masterworks and StoryGrid Contenders, because sometimes we might be like, oh, well, that's Tolkien. I'm not operating at that level. I wonder what Tim did. You know, like, how did Tim solve this problem? That kind of, you know, Tim's book works. I don't think it's as good as The Hobbit, but let's take a look at what Tim did, and then I can sort of cheat the difference. Like, maybe I can be better than Tim, not as good as J.R.R. Tolkien. Sorry, Tim, to throw you under the bus. But the same thing goes for Sean, too. Like, anything that I would write, you got, you know, his prose is a little turgid. Let me go. Maybe I can split the difference. So that's why we have contenders and masterworks, because guess what we got? We've got a spectrum of value there. So the more contenders we have, the more contender guides, the more masterwork guides we have, the more opportunities people, creative writers, will have to be able to solve problems that they think are impossible, because they're not impossible. They are not impossible problems. So, you know, this is the grand, grand plan for StoryGrid. You know, as you could all probably tell, we're not burning up Amazon, you know, bestseller charts with our releases. And that's on purpose. And we price our books on Amazon. Now, the guild members are a different equation here because it's all part of your subscription. But we price them very high. Like, they're $20 for a 100-page book. And a lot of people are going to look at that and go, what a ripoff. I'm going to pay $20 for a 100-page little tiny paperback? And the way I look at it is, we could make 500-page bullshit books filled with all kinds of junk in between and charge $25 for those. And it's actually easier to write a 500-page book than a 100-page book. Like, trust me, it's so much easier. Because you give yourself a break on so much crap. You're like, oh, well, that's a good transitional chapter that's 20,000 words. And then people are like, oh, what a bargain. I paid $25 and I got an 800-page book. But my point is, I'd much rather boil down. We boil everything down to the minimum so that every page is chock full of information that we can refer to quickly. Not have to read 35,000 examples about one specific thing. It's like we just boil it down. So anyway, that's what the StoryGrid Masterwork why is. Why are we doing this? The reason why we're doing this is to build better writers and to build better storytellers and to demystify problems that are absolutely solvable. They're very solvable problems, but we need a wide spectrum of problem solvers that have solved them that will trigger our own specific insights. So that's how I approach Masterworks.
How many times do you read a book before you actually dive in to do the masterwork analysis?
Well, I mean, they're masterworks. So usually, like The Hobbit, I read when I was a kid, and this is the great thing about a masterwork is that multiple readings reveal multiple meanings. Multiple readings reveal multiple meanings through time. That's what we're all shooting for, right? All right. So how many times do I read it? I will, all right, let's say it's a masterwork I haven't read yet. And now I've read everything, so no, I'm kidding. So if it's something I haven't read in a very long time, like Pride and Prejudice, right? I read that in high school. I loved it. I forgot about it. I moved on with my life. And then I thought, well, what's the perfect example of the perfect love story? Oh, well, that's an easy answer. It's Pride and Prejudice. Great. So why don't I structure a course about love around Pride and Prejudice? Okay. Ah, shit, I got to read it again. So I read it again, and it was wonderful, right? It's always wonderful. So I read it one time. I said, this is absolutely going to work. Now, let me do the spreadsheet. And then I went through it again. So I would say, read it once for the reading pleasure. So don't make notes. Don't do anything. Just say to yourself, I am not allowed to do any story grid analysis until I read this from start to finish. I think that's really important, because you can lose the forest through the trees if you're not, you got to take it in first. Okay, so read it once. So say I ask Larry to do The Hobbit. And so what Larry would do is he would read it again. He's probably read it a million times, but he would read it one time and go, yeah, that's as good, that still holds up there. And then he would pull up his spreadsheet, and then he would start doing the masterwork. So I would say, read it once for fun, and then get into it.
Okay. So this is from William. Both of this week's scenes are relatively long. The scene from All That Jazz is 7 minutes. Scene from Pride and Prejudice is 5,000 plus words. Are cast of 100 scenes typically on the longer side? If so, why?
I think they are. Cast of 100 scenes, I look at them kind of like in with the David Lean. You know, David Lean, that great British director who did Lawrence of Arabia. And so when I think of the cast of 100 scenes, I think of David Lean, because you can always, he always was creating these big sort of self-contained major moments in his stories, in his big, you know, canvas stories. And they came, and the way Steve Pressfield thinks about it is like, there are seven major, you know, events in a David Lean kind of epic story. And, you know, these are the grand battle scenes, the big ballroom scenes, the, Stanley Kubrick is famous for these too. So what's required with a cast of hundreds is that we need to position the protagonist and the antagonist in this global social world. And we need to establish all of the forces and the striations of class. So, like in your classic battle scene, you've got the guys with the bayonets who are charging, and then you've got the guys who are lighting the fuses on the cannons, and then you've got the generals on the hill, and then we focus in on our protagonist who's won in that thing. So it takes a while to build to these big events. So my advice about these cast of 100 scenes, and the brilliant thing about Fosse and All That Jazz, was that he had a big problem. His big problem is he wanted to tell a story about the meaning of life and death. And no one wants to go to that movie. If I say to you, hey, why don't we get on the phone and I'm gonna tell you the meaning of life and death, and how you can navigate the world in such a way that'll be good for you. No one wants to hear that. They want a story, right? I don't want to hear your interpretation about what it means when you die. No, thank you. So Fosse wanted to tell that story because he almost died. Fosse, the backstory about Fosse is that he was just a complete nutcase. He was your classic artist. So he basically didn't feel that anything that he did was worthwhile. I mean, he's the only guy who won a Tony, an Emmy, and an Oscar, I believe, in the same year. I think he's the only person to ever done that. And after that year, it was for the Cabaret, Liza with a Z, and something else. Pippin. All right. So he wins all three of these awards for directing in 1 year. And he was ready to kill himself at the end of that year because he thought he could never live up to that again. That's kind of says the way he felt about himself. He just never believed. He thought he was like razzle dazzling and was a bullshit artist. So what people like that end up doing is slowly killing themselves through vices, cigarettes, addictions, whatever. And he loved all those things. So he had this massive heart attack that he actually puts in the movie All That Jazz, right? And he almost died, and he had to have quadruple bypass or something. So after he survived that, he said, you know, I really need to do this. And he fell in love with a novel by Helma Wulitzer. I think that's her name. Yeah. And I think it was called Endings. But he could never figure out how to adapt her novel into a movie that people would, because reading a novel about death is more interesting to more people than a movie. So he finally asked a friend, I think it was E.L. Doctorow, who was a friend of his, and he sent him the script and he's like, what do you think? And he said, Bob, just why don't you make the lead character a choreographer? And then it dawned on him, oh, great. So when he constructed, so what he had to do at the very beginning, he knew it because I believe at this time, A Chorus Line was about to go on Broadway. And he had this rivalry with Michael Bennett, I think was his name, who's the creator of A Chorus Line. And so Fosse really loved and hated, you know, Michael Bennett. It's like, he's gonna outdo Cabaret. So I know he probably said to himself, I'll do a better Chorus Line. I'll do Chorus Line in 7 minutes at the beginning of my movie. And I will just basically blow up A Chorus Line as a creative enterprise. And I think he actually pulled it off. So the reason why I say that is the way he figured out how to solve his problem about talking about death in a way that would be engaging to an audience was to take people very specifically into the protagonist's code 1.0. This is the way this director operates. And it's fascinating to watch someone manipulate people to the degree that the Roy Scheider character does in this opening 7 minutes. So once we see this in beautiful, amazing world where you've got a 400 person cattle call and he boils it down to 10 dancers who are the perfect mix, right? They all don't look alike. They all don't have the same movement, but together that it's almost like creating SEAL Team Six. So Bob Fosse could create SEAL Team Six in 5 hours just by watching these people move. So Fosse figured out if I open my movie showing people what I do every day, maybe somebody would be interested. So he had the courage to show himself in a pure light. He's not a good guy. This is a guy who's manipulating people for his own ends. And he enjoys, you know, how was I as a director? You know, he's just a smarmy kind of gross guy, but we're like, yeah, we kind of need that guy to do the musicals. So the cast of 100 scenes are extended scenes, and you can approach them in a different, the way I always approach them is these are big turning point moments in a novel. So for example, I edited an epic fantasy novel called The Sand Sea, which we're about to release in June. And about the seventh edit, I realized we need a moment here that we just don't have. we need a transitional moment between the time when these characters are leaving one continent, getting on a boat, and going to another continent. And we need a big moment right before that. We need like a Godfather wedding moment, right? The beginning of The Godfather is a cast of hundreds scene. And it establishes everything we need to know about the Corleone family. So I said to myself, we need a big event that really, really transitions from the ordinary world to the extraordinary world. So at the end of this event, all these characters now know there's no freaking way I can stay back home. I gotta move on. So the author and I said, give me a ball scene. I need a, because it's set during the Gilded Age. I need a big ballroom scene. And if you can really pull it off, I need a ball in sort of in New York, and I need a ball in London. And I need the first sort of cross ocean communication to happen. That will be our big centerpiece for these two balls. So at the Gilded Age, this is the time when I think Marconi invented the Morse code or whatever. And they laid down the trans-ocean line between the United States and England. So we played off of that. And so they had this ball in London simultaneously with one in New York, and they set a cable. So anyway, so we crafted this big cast of 100 scene very, very specifically for this moment. And it's a long-ass chapter. I think it's 6,000-7,000 words. And the way we kept the narrative pace going was to clip between characters, because there are multiple sort of characters and protagonists in this novel, because it's an it's sort of like has six major characters. So we were able to clip between these two major characters throughout, and I think it works. But the reason why I'm bringing that up is if you think of a cast of 100s, you can only do this one or two times in a novel. So for example, Fosse has, at the beginning of All That Jazz, he has a cast of 100, and then at the end, he has the big, you know, the big ending number, which is great. It's a really interesting film. I mean, it's not perfect, but what is? But I watched it the other day, and it's very, it really speaks 70s in a way that's the 70s artist. And I think there's a level of, I think artists today are so corrupted by commercial considerations that there are very few artists who are in it like the Fosse's. Like, he died when he was 60. His brain just exploded while he was walking across the street. In of course, he was trying to put up a show, and he had lunch, walked across the street, had a cerebral hemorrhage, and died. Fell on the ground dead. And I think he would have loved, if he plotted his death, that's the way he wanted to go. So I think he got what he wanted, because he committed himself so fully to the creative act. And there was a lot of collateral damage, right? So there's a spectrum of value here. Anyway, I'm getting off topic. But the cast of 100 scene is really fun to write. And it's the kind of scene that you do a draft, you stick it as a placeholder in your book. And then what's going to happen is you're going to think about it. Oh, I need to have this specific moment. And then you'll go and recraft it. But those are the big moments when people really, they kind of look forward to the moment. Like, and Jane Austen was great at doing this. She would always set these things up by saying, like, wouldn't it be great if the Bingleys threw a ball? Oh, they would never do such a thing. And then, a few chapters later, it's like, I wonder if we could get Bingley to throw a ball. And so the reader is always like, when's Bingley going to throw the ball, right? So we have this anticipation for that big event. So that's another little cheat. But yes, these things are usually very long. And the reason why is that it's, these are major moments in our lives, usually when we frame them. You know, we all know those big events we have gone to in our lives. So yeah, they should be long. Anyway, go ahead. Anything else? Tim, are we all done with that?
No, I was muted. All right. This is another one in the cast of 100 scenes. This question is from Kim. I found it challenging to manage my point of view character, her companions, and then the big crowd of people. It was a tricky balancing act, like how often to zoom in and zoom out. For example, in the All That Jazz scene, we'd zoom out to see the big group of dancers and zoom in on individual characters. Any advice on how often to go back and forth between the two?
Yeah, it's obviously it's far more difficult when you're writing a novel to create the cast of 100 scene because Fosse didn't have to have any dialogue. That's a visual medium that a lot of people don't have that abstract capacity to think about their story in Spielbergian or Fosse terms. And what I suggest for novelists trying to capture a cast of 100 scene on the page is to go to the masterworks. So to see how Austin was able to pull off a point of view with Elizabeth, and we see some Darcy point of view there too, while interjecting all of this hubbub is really instructive. But the way I always approach these kinds of problems is I'm like in my mind, I'm a visual storyteller. So I would start sort of setting up some constraints in my mind. Okay, I want to do a ballroom scene. Where's the camera? Where are we open? What's the opening shot? Are we going to focus on the people stretching at the beginning? Or how are we going to do this? And then I would start constructing sort of these beat moments. Okay, and then, all right, now where's the camera going to go? All right, so who's going to narrate? How are we going to move the camera? Can we move the camera using multiple points of view? Yeah, do I want to do that? I'm not sure. So it's a lot of trying something, see if it works, and then trying something else. So yeah, you're gonna wanna, you know, pull back, bring it tight, pull back, bring it tight. And eventually, it's sort of, the way I would suggest it is if you think of like, start with a big frame, pull it down into your protagonist. So if it's a third person omniscient and narrative, you start with the description of the Bingley Ballroom or something. I'm just making this up off the top of my head. Or say it's the Battle of the Bulge, right? Unexpectedly, the snow came early, right? And with each, you know, with each flake, so did the, you know, the Nazis. Right? So you start with a wide frame, like set the field and then tighten it up and say, you know, Colonel Smith was blah, 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 blah. What do you think today? And then you go into with some sort of dialogue between, you know, the anticipation of the moment of the battle. And then you pull back again. Maybe you move over to where the Nazis are, right? What are the Nazis doing on the Battle of the Bulge? You know, these guys haven't eaten in 2 weeks. You know, the Third Reich is dead. There's no way they're going to survive. Why are they fighting? Why are they doing it? I mean, we're about, the American Allied forces are about to just take over. Why are they fighting this last conflagration? What is motivating them? So you move back and forth. What's motivating the Americans? What's motivating the British? And so you maybe have pockets of characters who are anticipating the crisis situation. This is the great thing about battle scenes. Everyone knows what the crisis is. Everyone knows what the crisis is. It's the moment when you have to pull the trigger, when you have to make the commitment to kill someone else to save your own life, or to save your brother or sister's life on your shoulder. So those battle scenes are usually about everyone planning how they're going to react. But battles are about chaos, right? So everybody's plans are going to blow up before that crisis moment. Because in the crisis moment is when character is revealed. When the shit hits the fan and the crisis, the best bad choice or irreconcilable goods crisis arises, that's when your characters reveal themselves. What actions they take reveal who they are. Do they dive in front of the, you know, the oncoming onslaught to save the person on their right or left? Or do they sort of shudder like this? That is a big moment. So think about, what's the crisis moment of the ballroom scene? Is she going to agree to have that dance or not? How is she going to approach it? Or is he? What are they going to do? Who's going to win the scene? All of these great constraining problematic questions are the way I approach crafting the scene. Who's going to win this scene? Why are they going to win it? Who's going to show their true colors? Because when the crisis arrives, that's when people show who they are. So in the cast of hundreds, usually you're talking about some kind of humiliation in a ballroom scene. It's some sort of social faux pas that someone makes, and the way other people react to that faux pas is a test of their character. So in the Pride and Prejudice scene, the Bennett family behave horrendously. They are embarrassing. And Elizabeth wants to pretend that it's okay that they're embarrassing, because who cares about social structure and standards? So she's not even wanting to accept or to, you know, I always say this, like the inciting incident for a protagonist, in the early stages, they don't even pay attention to it. They don't even see it. So Elizabeth in that ballroom scene doesn't even really fully connect the dots about the behavior of her family. Her mother's drunk, telling everyone that her oldest daughter's gonna get this Bingley guy. She's so beautiful, he won't, and she's gonna move into Bingley's house. The mother's that drunk saying that. Meanwhile, the sister's running around and trying to, like, one of the sisters is trying to hook up with some guys, you know, some. So she's running around, and then another weird sister's playing the piano and singing off tune and really freaking everybody out because she won't let anybody else play the piano. So it's all about social faux pas. So think about what's going on in this cast of hundreds scene that's weird, that the protagonist is either avoiding and not paying attention to it, and then will bite them in the ass later on. Anyway, you can see that there's multiple ways of looking at it, but what I always rely upon is my fantastical, imaginative, visual, internal movie director to kind of frame it in my mind. And then I think about, where's the conflict? Who's gonna win the scene? What is everybody trying to get out of this moment? Who's going to tell the story in the best way? So you'll see Fosse, he focuses on people in that opening shot that you never see again. But the what you know, them fixing their hair or fixing their makeup or stretching or practicing a turn of their hand, that is so telling that everyone wants that validation. I wonder if he'll pick me. And what that guy does with that power is both wonderful. He's not a tyrant. He understands how hard it is. When he personally says to people, I'm sorry, thank you for coming in. It's not going to be you this time. Now, not many people do stuff like that. I've been to a lot of auditions, and usually they cut you off immediately and they say, see ya, get out of here. It's humiliating. But he doesn't do that. So that's nice. But he's also working the room to find somebody to sleep with, too. So that's not cool. So you see, you've got both sides of the equation working. But I always fall back on if someone says to me, okay, we're going to give you the finest craftspeople in the world to film this idea. You've got an hour, Sean. And then you have to tell everybody what you want them to do. And you have to describe it. Go. Then I think visually, well, should I start with on a teacup or should I start wide? Well, I'm going to start wide. Like in The Godfather, Puzo starts, I believe, the first shot is a close-up of someone begging for help. And then it expands. So he doesn't open with the big super-duper wedding. He opens with a guy on his knees begging for help. And then, bang, he goes wide. And then he comes back. And then he goes wide. And then Michael shows up. And when Michael shows up, we've moved the camera to Michael. And the Godfather, what is he doing the whole time? He's looking out the window. When's my real son coming? When is the one I really love showing up? And then we get the close scene with Michael and Kay. And Michael tells him about Luca Brasi. And then says, that's my family, Kay. That's not me. Bang, set up. We know at the end, Michael's going to end up just like the Don. That's in the first 10 minutes of the movie. So think about these big cast of hundreds scenes as the big metaphors of your characters facing big, massive change in their life.
Okay, so dropping from these big scenes down to like a one-person scene, if the question for the big scene is who wins, is the question for a solo scene which aspect of the person wins, like their higher or lower nature? How does that work in a smaller cast or down to one person?
Yeah, I mean, the way I see individual change occur in the mind is that there are it's what I call code 1.0. So my code 1.0, when I face a problem, is I go right into cycling through a series of skills and ideas and things that I've used in the past to solve the problem that I'm facing. The unexpected event that occurs, I cycle through I open every drawer in my mind. And have you ever heard the expression, a carpenter sees every problem as the need of a hammer, right? So every problem can be solved with a hammer. So that's the mental problem that we have, isn't it, right? So each of us, in whatever state of cognitive strength or weakness we have, we have a set of tools that we use. And the character, the protagonist at the start of your story, all the way up until the midpoint shift, they're using from their code 1.0, they're using every tool in the box from their code 1.0. So if something happens, say, in the first part of the middle build, a progressive complication, your protagonist is probably going to enact an action that has worked for them in the past to solve the problem that they think they're facing in that moment. And so say it's a someone who has to make a choice in the beginning of the story, the protagonist will rely upon what they've done before. If I yell at this person, I can scare them enough that they will give me what I want. That's sort of like a very easy example of someone. Every time I've used my anger in the past, I've been able to get people and coerce them to do what I want, so I will just get angry. And then what happens in the story is the person who uses anger all the time to get what they want, they come up against problems that they can't defeat with intimidation or anger. And so they keep screaming at the problem or screaming at what they think the source of the problem is, but the problem's like, you're not scaring me. I'm not going away. So the whole process of a story, if we weren't really, is to get that angry person to have the insight that anger might not solve all problems. Now, all of us can sit back and say, well, geez, that's obvious, duh. But the trick is we don't see us bullshitting ourselves in the moment. We can really craft remarkable sets and series of excuses in our mind and rationalizations that allow us to constrict our cognitive abilities. So we sort of, instead of opening up our cognitive frame and trying to use things we've never tried before, because guess what? When we try things we've never tried before, it makes us vulnerable and we could get hurt. So biologically, we want to constrain our world so that we don't get hurt. But ironically, there are unexpected events that drop into our lives that can kill us. And if we don't open up our cognitive frame, we can't defeat them. So this is a great paradox. So in single-person scenes, when you get confused, think about, how is my character confining their cognitive energy, or are they trying to expand it? And that's where the rubber meets the road on that equation, is how they face the crisis best bad choice or their irreconcilable good question. So I know I'm speaking very abstractly, but I think generally the cognitive framing to think of your character on these general terms. At the beginning of my story, they have a very confined cognitive box. They've got all kinds of really good tricks in that box, like Bob Fosse does at the beginning of All That Jazz, right? He's a really great choreographer. He's going to do a great show. Everything's great. But then he has to shift his framing to, oh my God, I've destroyed the lives of people that I love because I hate myself. My self-loathing has destroyed every authentic relationship I've ever had. And he reaches a point of crisis. Well, what are you going to do about that? And I believe at the end, he dies. And that's a bummer. But the point of that story is, don't go through life like I did. And you've got to open up your cognitive framing and realize that you really shouldn't hate yourself. It's not a good prescription. So to think about like the cognitive framing at the beginning and the cognitive framing at the end, and what's the thing that forces them to blow it up or to contract it. So that's why All That Jazz is a tragedy. But it's got a lot of show tunes and razzle dazzle in it. Nobody thinks of All That Jazz as a bummer, but it is a bummer. Anyway.
All right, so this will be the last question. So you talk about having scenes that are potato chip length, usually around 1,500 words. So could you talk about having a scene that's, you know, 5,000-6,000 words and kind of moving between those potato chip length and then knowing when to have a big, long scene?
Yeah, I would use, as I said earlier, I would use the big 5,000-word scene as one of our big moments in the story. So we have 20 skeletal scenes, 15. I just added 5 to help people in the middle build. And that's in the action beat. So if anybody's confused about this new sort of 15 to 20 skeletal scene frame, just take a look at the action beat because I lay out the middle build one in that little beat. So I would think about like, do I want to use a cast of hundreds scene as a climactic scene of my beginning hook? Okay, so how do I make a 5,000-word scene so compelling that people will read the whole thing in one sitting? Well, there's a couple of tricks that you can use. You switch point of view. So if you have a multiple character cast, you can take the point of view from Darcy's point of view, and then Elizabeth Bennet's point of view, and then maybe somebody else's point of view, and you mix it up so that we're getting little snapshots of points of view from people, different people in the arena. So those little snippets would be 500 words, 1,000 words, etc. So you can do little cuts, like think of it as a movie director. You're cutting between moments and then stringing them together. So these are like almost beat, like larger in between a beat and a scene, you know, something like that. The other great thing about the cast of hundreds scene is that you can build to it. So this isn't a cast of hundreds scene, but Jane Austen is a great builder. She's always dropping in hints. Oh, let's go to the Lake District in a few months. Elizabeth, would you like to go with us on to the Lake District to visit? Yes, I would. Thank you. And then we get back to the present day and chapter. Oh, Elizabeth, you're going to be going to the Lake District soon, aren't you, dear? Yes. And then by the time the Lake District scene happens, your reader is so excited about them being on the lake, they'll read 5,000 words about it because they have been, you know, set up. So a lot of these big cast of hundreds scenes, you've got to set them up so that the reader isn't like, oh, shit, what, there's a ball now? Why is there a ball, right? So set it up with early references to future events that will become your cast of hundreds scene. And then when you do the cast of hundreds scene, your reader is excited. They're like, they put the book down when the ball comes, they go get a cup of tea, they go to the bathroom, and then they come back. And then they're like, yes, I've got my 5,000, I've got my big long chapter now, here I go. So think of it like you're reading the book. Or, you know, how do you react to different length scenes? What makes you wanna read that big cast of hundreds scene?
Okay, we'll stop there. Thanks, Sean.
Sure.
And we'll get this recording up in the guild later today. And I think Renee's gonna take over for the rest of our sprint today. So we'll end the Q&A here, and Sean will be back on Monday to do the assignment for next week.
Yep.